Welcome to the Florida Roundup on WLRN. I'm Tom Hudson. Thanks for listening. Ashkari Abdullah Muhammad may now die from lethal injection in a Florida state prison. He used to be known as Thomas Knight, and he's been on Florida death row for almost four decades. But he challenged the state's use of midazolam hydrochloride. That's one of three drugs used for executions in Florida. Muhammad argued the drug was ineffective as an anesthetic, but this week, the High Court here in the Sunshine State, the Florida Supreme Court, ruled otherwise. Are you for or against capital punishment in your name as a Floridian? Are you comfortable with the state administering this drug? Let us know at 800-743-WLRN, 1-800-743-9576. Email us at thefloridaroundup@wlrnnews.org. Tweet us using the handle at WLRN or the live chat underway now online at WLRN.org. Margie Menzel of the News Service of Florida, Brendan Farrington from the Associated Press, and Tia Mitchell from the Tampa Bay Times join us here on the Florida Roundup. Welcome to the three of you. Brendan, let me begin with you with the state Supreme Court ruling allowing the use of this drug to go forward. Any surprises, any reservations that the court announced in its ruling?
I don't think it was a surprise, given the judge in Bradford County's report that, you know, she felt that there was no evidence that either of the two gentlemen who had been executed by this new method had any pain or suffering. I kind of figured when they canceled oral arguments on the case that they were going to agree with the judge in Bradford County.
Let's give a little bit of context here, Margie. As Brendan mentioned, this was a relatively new combination. How did we get to this new combination of lethal injection?
Because the drug they had been using is just about unavailable.
And why is that?
Well, the manufacturer is a Denmark-based company called Lundbeck. It's called pentobarbital sodium. Mm-hmm. And so Lundbeck decided that they're not going to sell the drug directly to corrections agencies for use in executions, and they ordered their distributors to stop supplying the drug for lethal injection purposes.
And so, Tia, that led to a nationwide shortage for those states that had used that drug for lethal injection purposes, leading to the state of Florida to use this new drug, midazolam hydrochloride, which had been used in previous executions, leading to this this Supreme Court argument, correct?
Yes, it's been used. Florida's already used it in two executions, one on October 15th, another one on November 12th. But Mr. Knight, his execution was scheduled for December 3rd. And so he raised these questions about the procedure, and he said he alleged that the sedative didn't prevent pain after being administered, so that it wasn't, you know, that it would be, you know, cruel and unusual punishment to inject that for someone on, you know, facing death, that they would feel pain when they shouldn't have. So, but the Supreme Court looked into the case and they said, you know, it effectively renders the inmates unconscious, and that, you know, that it's fine to be used in lethal injection, but we don't know yet when Governor Scott will reschedule the execution.
The stay on the execution of Ashkari Abdullah Muhammad, a.k.a. Thomas Knight, has been lifted, but the execution date has not been set again from the governor's office. But Brendan, back to the argument that this gentleman was making based upon the two previous executions that used this combination and this specific drug, midazolam hydrochloride, his basis for his argument came from the use of that drug with the two previous executions in which it was administered?
Yes. The first prisoner that it was used on did not file any appeals. He wanted the execution to go forward. So there wasn't a chance at that point to challenge the use. I did witness that execution. I've written that it did seem to take a little bit longer for William Happ to lose consciousness, but I did not observe any signs of pain. I'm not a doctor, you know, I wouldn't say that I have the expertise to determine that, mm-hmm. but they did check to make sure he was unconscious before delivering the other two drugs in the process.
Brendan Farrington from the Associated Press, Margie Menzel from News Service of Florida, and Tia Mitchell with the Tampa Bay Times, along with me. I'm Tom Hudson. This is the Florida Roundup on WLRN. Your input is welcome at 1-800-743-9576, 1-800-743-WLRN, or join our live chat online at WLRN.org. It may not sound like a proper topic around the holidays here, but the Supreme Court did rule this week allowing one of the three drugs under consideration or under, critical examination for use of lethal injections in the state of Florida to be allowed. Presumably, an execution will be set for Thomas Knight, Askari Abdullah Muhammad, who was the death row inmate challenging the use of one of those medicines. Overall, however, folks, the executions in the United States, only 39 this year compared to the population on death row. And according to a report that was out this week, that's the lowest number in the past several years. Are there any particular reasons that anybody's been able to identify for that, either legal or otherwise?
Well, according to a report that was put out earlier this week, it just seems that the death penalty is getting more and more unpopular and states are doing it less and less. And that leaves several states, mainly in the South, that are more apt or they're the ones that are executing people, whereas several states, though they have the death penalty, it's legal in states like California, they're just not carrying it out these mm-hmm. days. And then some states, most recently Maryland, became the 18th state to outlaw the death penalty.
Two states, Texas and Florida, responsible for 60% of the executions nationwide this year. 16 death row inmates executed in Texas, 7 in the state of Florida. There are 405 people on death row here in the Sunshine State. The Florida Governor Rick Scott has signed 11 death warrants since becoming governor, 6 of those in the past few months. Are we led to believe then, Tia, that perhaps the pace of executions may pick up in the early part of next year?
Well, quite frankly, it could, especially with the legislation that Representative Matt Gaetz filed and that was pushed through the legislature this past year, that it's intended to speed up the death penalty once all the process and all the court cases. They say, they don't want people languishing on death row once you've been sentenced to death and once all your appeals and it seems that that you're going to be on death row. They want to speed up the carrying out of the death penalty.
And a number of those supporters of that legislation point, in fact, to Thomas Knight, Askari Abdullah Muhammad, for his almost 40 years, Brendan, who he has been on Florida death row, convicted originally of a murder in 1974.
Yeah, it's a long process. They do not, speed these guys through. I think, all of the recent executions, people have been on death row a long time. But I agree with the point that you and Tia just made, that I do think you'll see, an increased pace of executions in Florida. And the Department of Corrections made sure it stockpiled its new drug, midazolam hydrochloride. So they have enough to keep carrying them out as long as Rick Scott keeps signing the death warrants.
Brendan Farrington with the Associated Press along with us here on the Florida Roundup. Crime and punishment this week in the Sunshine State with the Florida State Senate President Don Gaetz calling on legislation to crack down on repeat sexual predators, calling that a centerpiece of the Florida House and Senate's legislative agenda in the new year. The sheriff of Polk County, just west of Tampa Bay, Grady Judd, he's also the president of the Florida Sheriff's Association.
These sexual predators, these deviants, will continue to offend and target victims, especially our children, whenever they're not incarcerated.
Now, this legislative proposal comes in response to a Sun Sentinel newspaper investigation this summer, finding safeguards that are supposed to stop sexual offenders at a high risk of repeating their crimes from returning to the general public have essentially failed. Tia, what do these legislative proposals hope to do?
Well, it's very interesting. There were four bills all filed on the same day this week. It was bipartisan. They're sponsored by Republicans and at least one and Democrats.
All right, three and Republicans and one Democrat signed on to the package.
And one Democrat.
Yeah.
Yes. And they do a variety of things. They give judges the option to increase sentencing for people who are identified as sexual predators. It creates better evaluation. It could require sexual predators to stay on probation longer. And so it's very comprehensive. It's Senate President Don Gates said they want to create a scorched earth kind of atmosphere for people who are labeled sexual predators, so they feel very unwelcome in Florida.
Margie Mansell with the News Service of Florida. Will critics be coming out arguing due process is being violated if these legislative proposals get passed in the springtime session?
I think that they have been really careful about that. In fact, I would go so far as to say what we're watching on this is our legislature operating at its peak capacity. We've got both chambers working together. We've got both parties working together. And they have been extremely comprehensive in examining what the loopholes are. And Duval County Sheriff John Rutherford, who testified before committees in both chambers, walked me through these bills on Tuesday when they came out and explained, you know, that two little girls were abducted and murdered in Jacksonville in 2009 and just last June. And so he has seen this really up close. And in the case of Cherish Periwinkle, the 8-year-old who was abducted from the Walmart in June, his officers had spoken to the person who's been charged, Donald Smith, at his home on the very morning of the girl's murder. Mm-hmm. So they kind of went through some of these cases with a fine-tooth comb. Smith, for instance, had he'd been in the county jail. He had impersonated a DCF worker trying to abduct two other little girls.
But I guess here's the question that critics may raise: going through individual cases in such a minute way, while certainly we all share the tremendous, profound sadness and shock with these stories. Identifying individual cases and coming up with legislative fixes could be problematic for unintended consequences years down the road.
Unintended consequences in terms of violating somebody's civil rights?
Due process, civil rights, overreach on the part of law enforcement or the court system.
I think it's with anything that comes before the legislature in Tallahassee, and that's what they always say, the devil's in the details. Mm-hmm. Because when you start making absolute rules and when you start having minimum guidelines and sentencing requirements, then that could be something that, you know, when there's always concern that once people are labeled, then that label, especially for sexual predators and sexual offenders, it's permanent in the consequences that come with it. So I do see the critics could say, you know, there's someone who was accused of something as a teenager, or they were labeled a sexual predator because of a crime that others don't think is on the same magnitude of a Donald Smith. And so it really will be about what the details of the legislation are. There's a lot of time between now and you know, this still has to go through the committee process and go through the approval process, and these bills will be amended and changed, and those will be worked out.
I'm sorry.
Margie, go ahead.
Let me just offer you an example of something in one of these bills that I think is really smart. Tia referred to the community control. What they have been doing is, okay, you get released from jail on the sexual violence offense, and then they can put you into the civil commitment facility.
Right.
You're serving your community supervision at the same time you're in this DEET facility, okay? So when you get out and you're at the point of the greatest temptation because you're fresh into the community after your incarceration, there's no control. One of these bills would address that and make it a split sentence. So the community control, the supervision would start after you got out of civil commitment.
Gotcha. Margie Menzel with the News Service of Florida, Tia Mitchell in Tampa Bay Times, Brendan Farrington from the Associated Press along with me here. I'm Tom Hudson on the Florida Roundup. Virginia joins us from Sarasota. Virginia, a member of our Public Insight Network here on WLRN Miami Herald News. Virginia, welcome to the program. Go ahead.
Good morning and happy holidays.
You as well.
I was calling just to express my disgust with this latest package that the legislature is considering in the realm of sex offender laws and ongoing punishment. I wanted to say that I believe what the people of Florida are doing in this instance is reacting to a very disturbing series of cases that have occurred, and they're reacting with hysteria. Hysteria does not make good laws. I think that rather than focusing on the ongoing punishment of people who have served their sentences, we need to look at where exactly these sexual offenses are being committed and by whom. What I see is a focus on identified offenders and ongoing, unremitting punishment.
Virginia,
until death of these people. I think you brought up some of these points.
Well, Virginia, by focusing on those who have been convicted of sexual predatory crimes, aren't we identifying those who are likely to commit sexual predatory crimes because they have in the past?
Not in the least, sir. The vast majority of child sexual abuse is perpetrated by someone within the child's own home or close social circle. We're talking about clergy, coaches, teachers. It's not perpetrated by someone who was arrested back in 1960 and who's on a public registry.
Virginia,
that is the myth driving this legislation.
Virginia from Sarasota, one of those critics here of the new package of laws, a new package, excuse me, of legislation that has been proposed for the General Assembly in the state of Florida here to take up in regards to sexual predators in the Sunshine State. Now, the state agency charged with protecting the most vulnerable children is the Department of Children and Families. And this agency has had three leaders in 3 years, and an agency whose budget has been targeted for cuts by Governor Scott. The Florida House Minority Leader Perry Thurston this week laid blame of the agency's failures at the door of the governor.
Last session, the governor undercut the budget of his hand-picked agency. And the result is that 40 children have died.
So that is Perry Thurston this week, a Florida House Minority Leader, criticizing Governor Scott's handling of the Department of Children and Families. Margie, we know that legislators have sent a letter to the governor. What sense of proposal to reform this agency are expected to be heard in the spring?
They're keeping it pretty close to the vest at this point, and they've been doing an exhaustive series of legislative hearings going back to September. Don Gates also said last week that he wanted some legislation that would constrain the role of the Secretary of the Department of Children and Families because, as you say, we see a steady stream of them. We've seen seven in the last 14 years. There's so many changes. Every time a new administration comes in, it goes back to square one. There's very little continuity. So Gates is saying, we're going to do something about this, but he's not saying what. I asked Eleanor Sobel, Senator Sobel, Democrat of Hollywood, who's chair of the Senate Committee on Children, Families, and Elder Affairs. She wouldn't tell me.
Mm-hmm. What's the sense here, Margie? Is it the sense, though, that these legislators don't have specifics yet? They're still forming the specific plan, or perhaps it's there and they're waiting for a moment, quite honestly, that may be more politically opportunistic to talk about this in the public sphere?
Well, I think they are really doing some serious digging.
Yeah.
Gail Harrell, the chair of the House Healthy Families Subcommittee, has been really working this, and she's heard from a number of folks. One of the big issues I think we're going to see relates to the cuts that we're talking about, which is a gap analysis. And it's one of the most important things DCF is doing right now to respond to the deaths. They're trying to say, okay, if we're going to identify children who are at risk, maybe they're not in danger this day, but the family dynamics are such that they will be in a month, or we can't predict exactly when, but soon. Domestic violence, substance abuse, mental health. Okay, you get the idea.
Yeah.
those are the other functions of DCF. Governor Scott's office is saying he's not going to cut child protection. But what else is there at DCF to cut that won't affect child protection?
Brendan and Tia, we have been here before with the Department of Children and Families in the state of Florida. We have seen, unfortunately, a long list of real horrific child deaths that, upon hindsight, warning signs were clear, where the state agency has come up short, and other state institutions that are involved with protecting vulnerable children have come up short. What's different? What's different this time?
Well, the state has been trying to address the issue, but it seems like they take one step forward and two steps back sometimes. For example, they're focusing and they've spent new money on making the DCF investigators more professional, being able to pay them more money so they can hire more qualified people. And that's something that they started doing last year. But the current situation was brought about, to give it a little bit of context, Governor Scott asked every state agency to give him kind of ideas of where they could cut their budgets. It was a requirement. Every state agency kind of had to participate in this exercise of cutting their budget. And then what Governor Scott is going to do is take all that information, and, you know, he also is looking for places he wants to cut taxes and all those types of things. But he's going to propose a budget in March or February. Mm-hmm. And it may or may not include those cuts that the agencies had to submit. And many of the agencies, including DCF, said, we're doing this exercise because we have to. However, we think these cuts would be detrimental.
Yeah, a little bit of a preemptive strike already.
Yeah, so it's an exercise. We don't know what the governor is going to actually propose in his budget. And even once he proposes it, the legislature has to go through its budget exercises and actually come up with the budget. And I think what the letter from Thurston and even the package that bipartisan group, that package of legislation, I think they're indicating that they don't have much of an appetite for cutting DCF spending this year. Now, again, we don't know that. That's going to be something that rolls out between now and May. But to me, the indications are that there's not a lot of appetite for reducing DCF spending.
Tia Mitchell with the Tampa Bay Times, Margie Menzel with News Service of Florida, and Brendan Farrington from the Associated Press, all here on the Florida Roundup. Thank you to the three of you. Still to come on our program, and along with you, report cards for public high schools in Florida. This is the Florida Roundup on WLRN. I'm Tom Hudson. Thanks for listening. The holiday season brought report cards for Florida public schools, and no public high school in Miami-Dade or Broward counties failed. None of them. A great majority of them scored an A or a B. Have you checked in with your neighborhood school as a parent? How important is a school's grade? As a teacher, how accurate do you think your school's grade is about the quality of the education going on in the classroom? Let us know here today on the Florida Roundup by calling 800-743-9576. That's 800-743-WLRN. You can also email us at thefloridaroundup@wlrnnews.org. We're also on Twitter at WLRN is the call sign, and the live online web chat right now at WLRN.org. Margie Menzel with the News Service of Florida, Tia Mitchell with Tampa Bay Times, still with us from Tallahassee, and our education reporter, State Impact reporter Sammy Mack from WLRN, also along with us. Sammy, overall, a positive report card for Florida Public Schools?
Well, it sure looks that way. It's really interesting because there is a rule. I mean, first of all, the formula for grading schools has changed dozens of times over the past couple of years. So there has been a lot of confusion from pretty much everybody who touches the educational system about what the grades actually mean.
And whether or not last year's grade is applicable to this year's grade.
Right, right. And that has been a constant sort of critique from people who are concerned that these grades are changing too fast to be meaningful. That said, for the schools that have gone from being F and D schools to A and B schools, you bet they're celebrating. And what? You bet that's meaningful for them.
Yeah, and we saw that certainly reflected in especially some urban high schools in Broward and Dade County, especially here in South Florida, schools that as recently as I think 5-6 years ago may have been failing schools that were essentially threatened with closure are now C, B, and A schools.
Right, right. And our colleague David Smiley at the Miami Herald captured a really beautiful moment at Miami Northwestern where the principal was saying that the kids in the classes, when they found out, were literally screaming and crying. Yeah. It was such a positive experience for
because
them.
That was one of those failing high schools just a handful of years ago.
That's right, yeah.
So what's the reward for a school for a good grade?
Well, it's really interesting. The if you get an F, and if you're consistently a failing school, there are sort of these services that kick into place that you get more monitoring and all sorts of things happen, that these sort of wraparound services become available to try and boost you up. If you get an A, you get bragging rights. And it affects, you know, like teacher pay and stuff can be connected to some of these things. So, what's really interesting about it, though, is when you talk to parents, we did a story, my colleague at State Impact, John O'Connor, and I did a story a few months ago where we asked parents, what do you make of school grades? What does your child's school grade mean to you? And one of the sort of common themes that we heard was, well, I don't think it's accurate, but you bet I check it every time.
Yeah, sure. Yep. Well, parents, call in. Grandparents, caregivers, teachers, administrators, let us know what you think about that school grade. How important is it to you? What about if you're in a neighborhood with a decent school grade, or for that matter, a school grade that you find less than desirable? You worried about that maybe having an impact on your property values, for instance, your resale value of your home? 800-743-9576, 1-800-743-WLRN. Tia Mitchell with the Tampa Bay Times in Tallahassee. Overall, a pretty decent report card for the state, but is it essentially null and void as we move into the next school year, 2014-2015, as Common Core becomes standard in all K through 12 grades in the state of Florida with public schools?
And that's what's so interesting about the school grades. I mean, look at it. We just got high school grades for the 2012-2013 school year. We're halfway through another school year. And, you know, now they're talking about raising the bar, changing the standards again, yet school grades for some schools are artificially propped up by the so-called safety net to keep them from dropping too low. So, and then you mix in Common Core, and there are so many moving parts, and some of the criticism of Common Core is that they say that Florida needs to slow down because the moving parts are frustrating to teachers and students and parents. But even without the Common Core discussion, the school grade formula has been changed and amended and altered. So it's very, very hard to compare and contrast. Yeah. Again, the school grades that just came out this week don't represent the current cohort of students in this current academic year. We're talking about last year's high school students.
Yeah,
that's right.
So it's just very interesting. I think you have to keep that in perspective as you talk about what these grades do and don't represent.
I can tell you as a public school parent of an elementary school student, the most frustrating thing is not the changing of the parameters or the standards of the school grades. It's not those kind. The most challenge is the volume of homework, quite frankly. That's the biggest challenge as a parent. But Sammy, Tia mentioned the safety net function. And how that has changed. I mean, we were kind of talking about celebration of these schools that have gone from failing now to passing. But what about those schools that are seeing a drop down in those grades and to the point of regulators trying to provide not only a safety net, but perhaps a little bit of cover?
Yeah, this is such a sort of tough thing to follow and be able to compare for that very reason, because there have been so many changes. There was over the summer an announcement made that there would be a safety net, that schools would not be able to drop in grades more than, I think, two grades. And so part of the criticism has been, you know, like you say you're toughening these rules, but then you have these safety net things. What do they mean? And again, you know, for the places that have gone up in a grade, they're looking at this as like a moment to celebrate. But at the same time, anybody else who's been dropping a grade, I'm sure, would be looking at this and saying, well, the formula's changing.
Is it a moment? It's not maybe not a moment to panic. It's a moment to criticize the standards.
Right.
Yeah. Margie, from your perspective, Margie Menzel, News Service of Florida, certainly the State Department of Education has had its challenges this year, and some of the critics of the leadership. Do these set of grades essentially justify?
You know, I think Pam Stewart has everyone's confidence at last, as she's been the constant throughout all of these changes. But to me, the fascinating thing, you talk about the standards. I don't think there's anyone who's an expert on education who wouldn't say these artificial standards aren't really addressing what we want our students to learn. And they are saying that the Common Core standards do that. So I guess it kind of begs the question to me, why are we going up and down with the grading formula? And I agree that we need to take longer to implement Common Core. That's certainly what I'm hearing over and over again from people who know what they're talking about. But isn't that going to solve some of these problems?
Perhaps more time could heal a bit of the wounds. Margie Menzel, News Service of Florida, Tia Mitchell with the Tampa Bay Times, and Sammy Mack here with State Impact Florida and WLRN. In Jacksonville this week, Nathan B. Forest High, it scored a C on these grades. Wasn't why the school made national news, though. The school is no longer known as Nathan B. Forest High. The Duval County School Board voted unanimously to change the name. Nathan Bedford Forest was a Confederate Civil War general. He was also the first Grand Wizard of the Ku Klux Klan. And Sammy Mack broke this story back in June, followed through with it this week from Jacksonville. Why did the school board vote unanimously this time when previous votes to change this school name had failed?
Well, first of all, I think it's important to note that when you say previous votes, the most recent vote before this one was in 2008. So this is really recent history that a school board in Florida elected not to rename a school that was named for the guy who was one of the first leaders of the Klan. And that vote in 2008 happened along color lines, and it was seen as a moment in Jacksonville's educational history where a lot of people looked at it and continued to look at that name as a very outward symbol of what a lot of people felt was some pretty serious institutional racism. And so this this effort to change the name came up again. It is a completely different school board this time around.
100% turnover.
100% turnover. They have a new superintendent who actually came from Miami. I think he was the chief academic officer here until November of 2012 when he took the job there. So a different group of people in leadership positions who VD originally said, you know, I've been hearing about this. I was alarmed by this when I first heard about it, and I'd be open to change if it comes organically from the community, which it did. There were 160,000 names on a petition to change the name, and he held a series of events where people had the opportunity to come and speak publicly about whether or not they wanted the name changed. And there were a lot of people who got up and said that this is part of our personal history.
Forrest was a slave trader. That is true. But again, it's being looked at with 2013 eyes, not 1860 eyes. At that time, it was a legitimate business.
And there were a total of seven people in our immediate family that graduated from Forest. My father, Burl, taught school there for 20 years.
It's part of my heritage. And it's part of my status as a veteran, sharing my status with Nathan Bedford.
And the flip side of that is we heard from students who this is a majority African-American school now. And the next day when they came back to school and it was no longer named Nathan B. Forrest, even though that's still on the marquee, that is going to change.
It's chiseled into the stone.
But that's technically not the name of the school anymore. I heard from one student, Tremaine McCreary, who had this to say.
Because it shows me that someone cares about my education. Now, they're not just sending me to a school named after a Confederate general. They're actually sending me to a school where change is being in place. My thoughts matter.
A little bit more context here, because I think time does matter a little bit here, Sammy, because as we heard one of the critics of this name change say earlier, 1860 eyes. This school was not founded in 1860. It was not founded in...
It was
close to 1960, and mm-hmm. Certainly we're in the early stages of the Civil War, civil rights movement, certainly in the southern United States, let alone nationwide. And the students of the school at that time did not want it to be named after this Confederate war general.
Yeah, as the story goes, in 1959, there was a vote held, and the students at this, what was then a new high school in Jacksonville, elected to be the Valhalla High Vikings. And at the very last minute, the Daughters of the Confederacy convinced the school board at the time to name the school after Forrest, who is widely held as a Confederate strategist and hero from the war. But, you know, of course, he was also the guy who was the first Grand Wizard of the Klan,
right,
and was, according to historians, very, very, very brutal with his wartime tactics. And I spoke to a historian this week who all he studies is how Southern schools get their names. And what he said, which I think makes a lot of sense, is that the names of civic institutions, and specifically schools, are a reflection of the values of the people in power at the time. And you can see that there, and you can see that in a lot of other places, too. And naming schools is not easy. Naming civic institutions is not easy, because people are people, and they have histories. But this was one of those things where it was so, I think, egregious to so many people that it was a surprise it hadn't happened sooner.
And we'll see how the practice of renaming a school goes in Jacksonville. Then, but that may not be an easy process as well. And
well, they can't use a person's name. There's a rule against that now.
Maybe a direction, then, at this point.
The street name is Firestone, reference. And that's one of the candidates.
Well, just a few miles west of Jacksonville, Margie, there has been another intense debate also related to the Civil War about a proposed monument for Union soldiers. Tell us a little bit about this controversy.
Well, I think the Department of Environmental Protection thought it was just another public hearing on where to locate a memorial. The sons of the Union veterans of the Civil War had gone to DEP and said, you know, we show visitors around the state park where the OSD battlefield is. They ask us where the Union marker is, and we have to say there isn't one.
Mm-hmm.
Well, you know, DEP accepted that. They vetted the proposal, and then they said, okay, here's some different places that we could put it. Let's have a public hearing in Lake City. And what they got was an auditorium full of angry people who objected to the process. And the Daughters of the United Daughters of the Confederacy are a factor here again, because they had given the land.
And Margie, it was more than just even a vocal crowd. It was a crowd that took to the microphone a little bit, quite a bit, in this hearing, singing Dixie.
Yes.
So what's the next step in this process for this proposed Union monument in North Florida?
I think DEP indicated that there was no rush about making this decision. They were going to go back and review it with the higher-ups, and I'll be astonished if they go forward with it, quite frankly.
Margie Menzel with News Service of Florida, Tia Mitchell with the Tampa Bay Times. Thank you to both of you in Tallahassee here today. Happy holidays. Sammy Mack, State Impact Education Reporter for WLRN. Thank you as well, Sammy. Always great to see you. We've got plenty more to come here on the Florida Roundup. The missing 5% from Miami-Dade County employee paychecks. This is the Florida Roundup on WLRN. I'm Tom Hudson. Happy holidays. Thanks for listening. If you get a paycheck from Miami-Dade County or Jackson Health System, you will not see 5% of your salary returned to you. A week ago, we could not be so definitive. The county commission failed to get enough votes to overturn a mayoral veto of the effort to restore pay. Patty Mazzei of the Miami Herald and Melissa Sanchez, also of the Miami Herald, along with me, talking about some local politics here. Patty, first of all, this Miami-Dade County Commission meeting, it seemed a week ago that the mayoral veto was assured, but there may be enough votes to overturn it. What happened?
Someone changed their mind. And a good sign of that happening is when you start one of these meetings where they're about to vote on a veto, and they just, instead of just taking a vote right away, they start talking for a long time. When they start talking, it's that somebody is having second thoughts and somebody needs to be persuaded. And that's what we saw on Tuesday.
That somebody was Chairwoman Rebecca Sosa. She had voted before to return the workers' money. Now she stood with a veto.
I'm not going to vote to fire employees in this camp. And you do it, you do it, but not because of my vote.
That said, it wasn't overturned. It stands. 5% remains deducted from county employees' paychecks.
Correct. So even though a majority of the commission, 8 of 13, voted to restore people's pay, they needed 9 votes. And so the veto stands, and now the administration needs to come up with a new way to resolve the labor contract impasse with the unions.
And I want to talk to you about the proposal that Mayor Jimenez offered while he did veto in a moment. But we got a tweet from listener Dan Lopez that the 5% taken out of part-time employee paychecks, even though they don't get health insurance from the county. Can you confirm that?
Yeah, that's the case, as I've written before, because this was a fix in order to avoid an across-the-board wage cut during the recession. That would have hurt people's pension payouts down the line. So instead, the agreement was, you know, we're going to solve the wage issue by charging 5% of pay for health insurance.
Regardless if you participate in the health insurance plan on the part of the county or Jackson Health or not.
Correct.
And so Mayor Jimenez, in his veto, did offer an olive branch of sorts, saying, okay, we're going to, we've got to continue to take the 5% from county employees, but for lower paid workers, we'll provide a bonus that more than makes up for that.
He offered a one-time payment of $1,500 to people who make less than $40,000 a year and of $1,000 for people who make less than $50,000. But the commission was kind of lukewarm to the idea. There are some commissioners who would prefer to just restore a smaller percentage of people's paychecks recurring fashion and not just on a one-time bonus. So they're going to have to come back to the drawing board in the new year.
Is the mayor's plan dead in the water then?
I can't say it's dead yet. We're going to have to see what they come up with. He has pledged to sit down with the unions. Now, the unions have been very critical about the mayor just not negotiating with
right.
them, and they say that there's no good faith there. So there is a lot of repair work to be done in that relationship.
And to be clear, can you categorize the negotiations as, you know, there's one thing to say that they won't negotiate, which presumably means they're literally not having meetings versus not negotiating in good faith. They're having meetings, but they're not making any progress.
The unions would say that they're just not having meetings. I mean, that this impasse was declared, you know, on day one or day two and didn't really give it a chance to play out over time. The mayor said he had a time constraint and he didn't think he was going to budge. So.
What kind of deadlines are we looking at in 2014?
I mean, the longer it takes to fix this problem, the bigger hole you could face in the middle of the budget year to resolve it. There's no, like, drop dead date. But that's always the looming threat. Like, okay, if we just put this off, then the budget could take a big hit.
And we happen to be moving into an election cycle as well.
Yes. We are.
Patty Mazzei, covering county politics in Miami-Dade County for the Miami Herald. Melissa Sanchez covers City Hall politics throughout a number of, boy, very interesting locations here in South Florida. And what a year it's been here, Melissa. Another year in which we saw local public officials hauled off in handcuffs, accused of corruption from Homestead to Sweetwater. You've covered this corruption. What are the underlying commonalities behind the local political corruption that you covered here this year that we saw in South Florida?
Well, I think one thing, and I know Patty and I have been covering this for more than a year and a half. We started off this year thinking that we had a new beat, which was absentee ballot fraud.
Right.
And I think that's one thing that we've seen over and over and over again last year with just huge problems in Hialeah in terms of elderly voters whose votes were basically being taken by other elderly voters who were working for political candidates across the county. This was touching the state attorney's office. This was touching the mayoral candidates, both at the county and city levels, state legislators. And this year, as Patty wrote about, we saw a change in some of the absentee ballot fraud strategy going more online to do absentee ballot requests that were fraudulent. We saw it again a few weeks ago in Homestead, where typically we've been seeing this with a lot of Hispanic voters in mm-hmm. the Hialeah, Miami area.
These were the ballot brokers.
The ballot brokers in black neighborhoods in Homestead. This was touching a municipal race there where the husband of a county commissioner was being accused essentially of having hired somebody who was committing ballot fraud.
And describe to us how prosecutors allege this ballot fraud has evolved, has stayed ahead of either regulations or law enforcement. How does it work? How's this ballot broker procedure? How do prosecutors say that it works?
Literally, well, you have people who work for campaigns who are paid daily, either by the ballot or by the day, to visit dozens, if not hundreds, of voters who they typically visit election after election after election. These become friends of theirs who they visit on a regular basis and give gifts to. And when their absentee ballots drop and candidates have access to data that tells them what day ballots are delivered, then they knock on their door and ask them if they need help filling out their ballots. A lot of these folks are elderly, they're lonely, they don't have many people come visit them. And so they accept the visit from their friend, and they accept their friend's advice on who they should vote for.
Patty, is, you know, play a little armchair therapist here. Is it a matter of a disenfranchised voting bloc? Is it a disengaged voting bloc where these kinds of fraudulent activities seem to be able to take root and flourish?
Well, when we saw these bulk online phony ballot requests earlier last year and this year, they targeted people who had registered to vote but were not frequent voters or voting at all. And so I'm not sure if they're disenfranchised or maybe just not paying attention, and so campaigns see that as easy prey to go after in these schemes.
And Melissa, wherein lies the legal controlling authority? Is this a state issue where the State Elections Commission needs to step in and batten down?
I think the state legislature needs to step in, because it seems to be way too easy for folks to vote absentee, and you can't put enough cops on every street corner to watch whether somebody's walking out with a ballot.
And in the meantime, you'll get those that will say, listen, it's becoming harder and harder to actually go to a polling place and vote or become an officially registered voter in the state of Florida, with
true,
lots of concerns around that.
Especially in Miami-Dade County.
That's right. Yeah. So you know, give us the balance between that. Find the balance here. Is that, you know, we're moving into 2014, what's going to be a significant election cycle here in South Florida, not only with city halls and county commissions, but also with the governor's race.
I don't know. I think, I don't know what the solution is, but I know that the people who have the power to find solutions won't benefit from them, because their campaigns, especially politicians here in Miami-Dade, have depended on the system that uses ballot brokers to buy elections for them. So many of the politicians, I could name them, there's dozens of them. And this, like I said, this is state legislators, senators and representatives.
Right.
This is the county level, at the city level. I don't know how we can expect them to change the system that they have become elected on for and keep getting reelected on. They use the same political consultants who have been accused all over the county of doing this, and it's really frustrating, because we see this over and over and over again, and cases keep getting dropped, they get transferred, they get dropped, they get dropped, they get dropped.
Is this a Department of Justice and question at this point, perhaps?
I'm not sure if it's a federal issue, but it's...
Well, you can see the frustration
face. And at the end of the day, the only people who even get accused in court of any of this are the elderly people who they've hired to do this work. We haven't seen a single candidate get charged.
These are the frontline ballot brokers,
right?
The ones that are getting paid per ballot to collect, or
these are poor, uneducated people who could use $100 a day or whatever it is that they get paid. The politicians who hire them never get charged.
So give us an expectation about your level of validity of this election cycle that we're coming up. What ought to we be aware of? What should our radar be up for as we're moving into what's going to be a very expensive election cycle in the state of Florida as well?
I think we should pay more attention to the political consultants who get hired, and there needs to be more transparency in how they spend the money, because candidates can pay consultants thousands of dollars and the consultants aren't reporting what they're spending that money,
right,
or who they're paying.
The candidates have to report that, but their consultants, their advisors, don't necessarily report if they're independent parties, third parties.
And so there isn't a lot of transparency in that, and so it's hard to tell where the fraud is taking place or where the money is coming from. And that's something that I wish that we could spend more. I don't know how. I wish that there could be more transparency on that.
Melissa Sanchez with the Miami Herald, covering politics here in South Florida. Patty Mazzei doing much the same. Thank you to you both. Happy holidays and happy new year. That is the Florida Roundup for the program. If you missed any part of it, we'll be back on the air tomorrow morning, as well as on the website at WLRN.org. The Florida Roundup is produced by Elaine Chen and Alicia Zuckerman. Our Public Insight Network analyst is Steph Farrell. The executive producer here at WLRN is Peter J. Meritz. Our technical supervisor today is Paul Leary. Happy holidays, Mr. Leary. Stay tuned. South Florida Arts Beat with Ed Bell is next. It is going to be a hot show. Ed has his Christmas holiday light necklace on. We've got holiday jazz coming up in the performance studio from downtown Miami, from throughout South Florida, and worldwide on the internet, of course. Monday morning on the Sunshine Economy, an encore presentation as you're rushing to get that holiday shopping done. We present the reality of retail in South Florida. I'm Tom Hudson. This is the Florida Roundup. Thanks for listening.